Afternoon, Your Honors. John Spadaro for the appellant Edward Price III. Your Honors, the primary overarching issue, I think, on this appeal is this issue of acceptance of an offer to settle, of an offer to enter into a settlement contract by conduct, acceptance by conduct. I don't think any reasonable reader reviewing the briefs could deny that State Farm has not answered this issue, this implied in fact contract issue, at a substantive level. That is, State Farm in its answering brief does not deny that when you're talking acceptance by conduct, you're talking implied in fact contracts. State Farm has not denied that an implied in fact contract cannot exist alongside an existing express contract relating to the same subject. State Farm has not denied that the party arguing the existence of an implied in fact contract bears a heavy burden of proof. And State Farm has not denied the principle that an implied in fact contract must, in order to exist, must be entirely unrelated to the party's express written contract. What they've argued is that procedurally the implied in fact issue is not before the court, and that as applied to insurance settlements, it will cause mischief. I think we've addressed in our brief why that's wrong, but very briefly, we've argued from the start that there was no meeting of the minds. If you look at this court's decision in Capital Management v. Brown relies on the Iridium Africa case that was a report and recommendation by Magistrate Judge Thying that was later adopted by Judge Farnan at the district court level, specifically talks about implied in fact contracts requiring, like any contract, a meeting of the minds. We've said below, we've said here, again and again, there was no meeting of the minds. Now, the term of art appeared for the first time in the papers on appeal, but State Farm argued acceptance by conduct below. We opposed that argument. The trial court found acceptance by conduct. It's simply another name for an implied in fact contract. There can't be an implied in fact contract here, Your Honors, because here there was already an existing express contract relating to the same subject, that is, the obligation of State Farm to pay covered uninsured motorist claims and to pay fair value on covered uninsured motorist claims. The other overarching issue is the issue of unreasonable delay. The trial court found that there were no reasonable inferences to be drawn in favor of Mr. Price that would allow a jury to find that the 15-month investigation here constituted unreasonable delay. In fact, the trial court found fault with Mr. Price for taking as long as he did to sue State Farm, for taking as long as he did to place State Farm on notice of the claim. It's undisputed that Mr. Price, who may be among the most unsophisticated claimants State Farm has ever encountered in the state, did not even realize that he had either personal injury protection or uninsured motorist claims arising from this hit-and-run accident, that he found that out by happenstance. He happened to drop off a premium payment personally to his insurance agent, who told him, you know, you have a claim, and at that point the claim was tendered immediately.
Mr. Spadaro,
yes, sir.
One of the problems I have with your position, or your side's position, is that it's not clear to me what you're contending that State Farm should have done. Well, aside from just offering the whole $100,000 policy limits. I mean, if that were, you know, the only changed fact, would you still be arguing that there was no acceptance by conduct?
That is, if State Farm had tendered the full policy limits?
Yep.
No, because there would be no right to further policy proceeds. We would still be arguing delay, but set that aside. And there's an independent claim for bad faith breach of contract by virtue of the delay. But if State Farm had simply tendered the full policy limits and he had cashed the check, whether he thinks more is coming or believes that more should be coming, at that point doesn't matter, because you've exhausted the policy limits, and that's all he's entitled to. What State Farm should have done...
Let me eliminate that, then. Probably too easy a hypothetical. Let's make it $95,000.
Well, I would still be here because that would have, the value of this claim so far exceeded the policy limit that the policy limit should have been tendered, and it should have been tendered about 7 months before it was. But what State Farm could have done and should have done differently, I think the real omission that brings us here is the failure to have a writing. I mean, it's to me, it's unheard of that auto insurers settle claims without a writing. If State Farm had said, here's a document, you're releasing all claims, and sign it, and we're done with you, and he had that document, and now he's in a position to read the document, perhaps understand it, perhaps not, take it to a lawyer, perhaps not.
Well, isn't that the real problem here? Mr. Price did not have a lawyer, never retained one, and he was basically on his own. And State Farm knew that, or at least it had no reason to believe otherwise.
Yes, sir.
Doesn't your position amount to the contention that State Farm basically should not have done anything to close on any offer of less than the full coverage without notifying or advising Mr. Price to get a lawyer first?
No, we don't contend that they have an obligation to tell him to go out and seek representation. What they have an obligation to do under Title 18, Section 2304, Subdivision 16N, is they have a statutory obligation to provide a reasonable explanation, calculated to be understood by ordinary consumers, of the basis in the policy, in the facts, in the law, for the offer of compromise. That's
so
what
they had to write him a letter explaining precisely why they were offering $50,000 as opposed to $100,000.
The statute requires that they explain why they arrive at a particular offer of compromise. Yeah. Now, if you're offering the policy limit, it's superfluous. The explanation is superfluous.
Does the statute require that that explanation be in writing?
No, it doesn't.
And was the explanation given?
No, according to Mr. Bell, the adjuster for State Farm, he did not explain the basis why he was offering $50,000 as opposed to $60,000, as opposed to $70,000, as opposed to $100,000. He did not advise Mr. Price that he even had a claim for lost future earnings that might have value. That's undisputed. And in fact, when my co-counsel, Mr. Krawitz, who's at counsel table today, deposed Mr. Bell and tried to find out, why did you offer $50,000? What was the rationale? Why not $100,000? The witness was, I think, three times instructed not to answer. State Farm has never explained, not below nor in this court, how they got to $50,000. Maybe they'll tell us today, but it'll be the first time anyone has ever heard it. So the statutory requirement under the Unfair Trade Practices Act that when you make an offer of compromise, this is 18 Delaware Code, Section 2304, 16N is a Nancy. When you make an offer of compromise, that you...
Okay, well, I think one of the conclusions of the trial court was that that statute doesn't apply.
Well,
so let's assume for the moment that that's correct. Does your argument then collapse?
No, Your Honor.
Or do you still make the same argument but based on some other legal premise?
Yes, the other source of law, and there is another one, is the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. You cannot deal fairly with an unrepresented layperson without explaining the basis for the offer of $50,000 as opposed to $100,000. Especially, you cannot deal fairly with a man like Mr. Price when he's put you on notice.
Okay, so you're grounding the same argument on the implied covenant.
Yes, the same argument is grounded in those two separate sources of law.
If it's the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing you're talking about, why would the duty be any different that's owed to Mr. Price and owed to Myron Steele?
Well,
do you have to make some judgment contractually about how sophisticated your other contracting party is in order to meet your duty? Is the duty a moving target?
No, Your Honor. It's the same duty for the most sophisticated and the least sophisticated. But the duty exists.
Well, you just said the duty was breached because Mr. Price was unsophisticated.
Not because he was unsophisticated.
Well, maybe I misunderstood you, but I thought that's exactly what you said.
No, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is they have an unsophisticated, unrepresented person.
Because he was unsophisticated and unrepresented?
No, it's not that either, Your Honor. You don't have to have a lawyer in order to impose a duty on the insurance company to deal fairly with you.
And the insurance company's duty is the same whether the insured's a lawyer or a professor at Columbia Law School or any other worker of any kind.
That's right. So if you're a professor at Columbia Law School, you should be able to look at the policy and look at the uninsured motorist coverage part and know what you bargained for. You can't do that here. The Chief Justice of this court cannot do that here, because when you go to the UM coverage part, it doesn't tell you what it covers. It doesn't tell you that lost future earnings are covered. So that's never told to the policyholder at the time that the product is sold. Then we have Mr. Price, and this is what I'm getting at. The duty doesn't arise because of his lack of sophistication. The duty arises both by virtue of the Unfair Trade Practices Act, and I agree there's no private right of action, but I believe it does apply. But it also arises because he put them on notice that I'm going to have lost future wages. There are two or three references in their activity log where he's telling them, I'm worried about lost future wages. I'm worried that I'm not going to be able to be an elevator mechanic anymore. I'm worried that this is going to cost me earnings in the future. So you have a duty to investigate that. He's put you on notice that he has that concern. Well, I'm the insurance company. It's my duty to investigate. Let's see the extent to which he has a lost future earnings claim. Now, if they call the treating physician in September of 2009, he testified that he had determined by September 2009.
Two quick questions.
Sure.
Following up on the Chief Justice's. Number one, to the extent your argument is grounded on the implied covenant, what case or other authority do you rely upon for the proposition that the implied covenant in this context required the kind of explanation that you've described? That's the first question.
If Your Honor, it's not directly on point, but if Your Honor refers to Pierce v. International Insurance Company, there's an adoption in Pierce of Williston, rather of Corbin on contracts, that talks about how muscular the duty of good faith and fair dealing is. Its adherence not to just to the letter of the agreement, but to the spirit.
I understand, but is that an insurance case, or is that just a broad statement of contract law?
Pierce is an insurance bad faith case arising under the workers' compensation statute. But it's a workers' compensation.
Is there a fundamental legal principle difference between a, quote, bad faith insurance case, a general contractual duty of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and the Consumer Fraud Act that you set forth in your brief as a basis for a private action that you argue is not preempted by the insurance commissioner? Or how does this all relate together?
Well, we didn't plead the Consumer Fraud Act. We referred to it in a footnote to try to illustrate the level of candor the General Assembly would like to see when commercial actors deal with...
It's in your brief, though.
Well, it's in our brief because the court then ruled that there's no private action for insurance claims, and I thought, well, we've succeeded in mucking up the law on that.
Well, you certainly succeeded in confusing me. If that's not mucking up the law, thank God there are two other people up here. But I'm trying to determine how this is all interrelated. The general bad faith case against insurance carrier, which I remember fondly from afar, the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, which is just a general contractual principle, and then this invocation of the Consumer Fraud Act.
Well, the Consumer Fraud Act attacks misrepresentations and omissions. Clearly, if you're misrepresenting things or omitting things that should be provided to the consumer, you're going to risk running afoul of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. In DuPont v. Pressman, this court said, and this is a direct quote, insurance is different, period, full stop. In DuPont v. Pressman, this court said, you can't recover punitive damages for bad faith breach of contract in an employment contract context, but you can in insurance, because in insurance, people aren't able to cover independent of the... If we're able to cover the loss, I wouldn't need insurance. And there's an incentive to delay. There's an incentive to drag one's feet. There's an incentive to lowball. So that's why we have this muscular and unique to insurance contracts body of law on the duty of bad faith, of good faith and fair dealing. Its interaction with the Consumer Fraud Act, there are going to be many cases, and I've pled many cases where I've pled both a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing on the one hand, and a breach of the Consumer Fraud Act on the other. Because if you're running afoul of the Consumer Fraud Act, the chances are you're not dealing fairly with your consumer.
Well, if we were to agree with your implied covenant theory, wouldn't the consequence of that be that all of the prior arrangements would have to be rescinded? Your client would have to give back the $50,000 to the insurance company, and they would start all over again litigating, whatever the claim was. Or maybe they wouldn't. I mean, what exactly, would be the real-world consequences of accepting your theory?
The real-world consequence is that we would be looking at the situation contemplated under 10 Delaware Code 4317, which is the right given to insurers and their insureds to give and receive partial payments on a without prejudice basis. And State Farm's adjuster testified that they do this all the time. Your lawyer thinks the bad faith claim's worth, that the UM claim's worth $100,000. We think it's worth $75,000. We will give you, in order to meet our duty of good faith, since that part's undisputed, we'll give you the $75,000 as an advance, and then we'll litigate the rest. So there wouldn't be properly a return of the $50,000 because State Farm, by paying the $50,000, has acknowledged
that it...
Okay,
so your client would be able to keep the money but would have another bite at the apple.
It would really, in our view, be the first bite of the apple because he never settled this claim.
All right, you can save your time. Go ahead.
I'm happy to address whatever it is Your Honor has on her
mind. Well, I'm just curious because it seems the most preliminary question is, was this a settlement? And I thought there are at least disputed issues of fact with respect to that. Am I missing something?
No, there are disputed issues of fact. A jury might draw inferences against Mr. Price and say, we think he did manifest by his conduct acceptance. But a reasonable jury might also say, no, he didn't. Because he wasn't told, even though he raised concern about lost future earnings, he wasn't told that that was part of the package. It doesn't say that in the insurance policy. He was in dire financial straits, and we quoted at length the testimony in from his deposition that showed that he was in dire financial straits.
But to have a settlement, you have to have a settlement of a disputed claim. And the argument made here, and I think what the court found, is that there was no disputed claim.
That's right, and that's why there was no accord and satisfaction, because there was no dispute. So how can there be a settlement?
If there was no disputed claim, then there wouldn't be any material dispute of fact.
Well, the court below found that you can have a settlement independent of the absence of an accord and satisfaction. I'm assuming that ruling survives as we go to trial. But that's how the trial court felt, that you can have a settlement independent of an accord and satisfaction. I argued below, I remember saying specifically...
I'm not sure what the difference is.
I remember arguing below that there was no difference, that there's no doctrine of settlement, that either there was an accord and satisfaction or there wasn't. We've maintained all along that there wasn't. The trial court found that there wasn't, and there's been no cross-appeal on that issue. But at a minimum, there would be a material issue of fact as to what inferences to draw from the cashing of the check under these circumstances. I believe I've left myself about a minute.
We'll save that time.
Thank you so much, Your Honors.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Good afternoon.
May it please the Court, Colin Schalk on behalf of State Farm. The argument here today is different from the argument that's been made all along. And there's just a few points I wanted to make to the Court on some of the facts. It's pretty clear that when Mr. Price spoke to Amanda Dixon, the State Farm agent, in February 2009, he didn't understand that he had a claim. She understood that, so she reported to State Farm. State Farm did what you'd expect it to do. It opened two claims in this case, a no-fault or PIP claim, and it opened a UM claim. And I'm going to refer to it as UM because I know that we commonly understand that uninsured motorist claims are referred to that way. It is undisputed that Mr. Bell, on behalf of the State Farm's UM carrier, explained the concept of a UM claim to Mr. Price in late February 2009. It is also undisputed that he spoke to him over the course of time. And I think the testimony has been about a half dozen conversations over the course of time. Early on, Mr. Price said that the accident happened at a certain time, and there have been three different dates provided, one in May 2008, one in July 31, 2008, and one in September of 2008. The official date is actually July 31st, 2008. And I say official because it's unclear as to when the date was, so I served interrogatories, and that is the official date, even though the testimony is that the treatment started in May 2008, 2 months before the accident actually occurred. State Farm investigated the matter over the course of time, and what it did was it had someone take a look at the accident scene to see if there was surveillance tape, which, of course, there wasn't, but in any event, since there were three different accident dates spread over about four different months, you wouldn't expect there to be such a claim.
Mr. Schock,
yes.
I think it would be helpful, to me at least, if you could focus your argument before laying out the facts on what your side concedes to be the issue that we need to decide. I understand that the broad issue is whether the court should have granted summary judgment. But there have to be some, you know, some underlying issues.
I will do that.
I'm not sure exactly what they are.
Okay. The first issue that the plaintiff raises, and as I said, it's changed from below to here, is whether there was in fact a settlement on May 18, 2010. State Farm investigated the matter, and as a consequence of that investigation, it contacted Mr. Price and said to him, "We're offering you $50,000 for your uninsured motorist claim." When I served the interrogatories, the response came back that he didn't know what the money was for.
When you say, was there in fact a settlement, do you mean by that a court and satisfaction, or do you use settlement another way to express the term contract?
Your Honor, when I drafted the answer to the original complaint, which made its way into the second amended complaint, I knew that at least one of the bases was an accord and satisfaction. But I also said in the affirmative defense, and such other and further legal contentions may appear, because when the original complaint was filed, it was simply a generic uninsured motorist claim. There was simply no contention that there was any bad faith. There was no acknowledgement of $50,000. It was simply, we want $100,000 with no explanation that they received $50,000. As the discovery ensued, it became clear that the plaintiff did acknowledge receipt of $50,000. He acknowledged that he got the letter saying it was settlement of the uninsured motorist claim, and he acknowledged having deposited that check on May 21, 2010. With all of that, I then canceled the deposition of Mr. Price, and it was taken much later in the litigation. So it is hard to understand when State Farm said, we are offering you $50,000 for your uninsured motorist claim, which was accompanied by a letter after the fact, that is, after the telephone conversation took place. Mr. Price says it's about time, or great, whichever. There was a difference of opinion. I think Mr. Bell's comments about what Mr. Price said were a little more affirmative. And, of course, Mr. Price said, well, it's about time. But they're both the same thing. Neither one said no. And effectively, by saying it's about time and accepting the check and accepting the letter that went with it, the case was settled at that point.
So it was a contract.
Yes.
Distinguished from an accord and satisfaction.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Isn't there an issue of fact about that? Isn't Mr. Price claiming that he did not understand that payment to be the full settlement of the entire claim, but merely a payment on his claim?
The trial court dealt with that issue, Your Honor. And the question and the dialogue that Mr. Price and I had about that during his deposition was, I said, you think it was a partial payment. Did State Farm tell you that? And the answer was no. Did you tell State Farm that? The answer was no. Did you think it was worth more than $50,000? Yes. Did you tell that to State Farm? The answer is no. The question then really is, if you understand that you are getting $50,000, but you have an unspoken thought in there that there may be more coming, and you don't ever express that thought, there's no question of fact that can be discerned. The contract was evidenced by the fact that he accepted the money and that there was a conduct which evidenced the settlement. Having a thought running around your head that maybe there's more coming or maybe I want more is not a factual dispute. There's simply State Farm saying, I offered the money, and Mr. Price saying, I accepted the money. There's no dispute of fact at all.
But in terms of a meeting of the minds, if Mr. Price did not understand this to be the full settlement, then don't we have an issue as to that?
Not at all, Your Honor. Because when you accept that check, which says with it a letter saying this is in settlement of your claim, if you think there's something different, if you think that there's some confusion on the part and there's no meeting of the minds, you have to contact the other side and say, I dispute that. He did not do that. I guess my point is that if I were to settle a case with a lawyer and I was sending him a check, and sometimes we send a release and sometimes we don't, we have a settlement agreement, and somewhere along the line he has a different thought in mind and he doesn't express it, that's not a dispute of fact. And that's what occurred here. There is simply no factual dispute at all. He deposited the check with the letter that said what he said, and he acknowledged that is all that State Farm said to him and that he never expressed anything to the contrary. The bemusing part of this case that I found difficult to deal with over the course of time is the obligations that the plaintiff is trying to place upon State Farm. And I identified most of them during the course of the briefing that was done in this case. When the amended complaint was filed in September 2012, the amendment stated that it was the obligation of the insurance carrier to find the verdict of a reasonable Delaware jury or to survey the bar to figure out what the bar thought that the case was worth, something that's impossible to meet. I addressed that issue in the court below, and the response then came back, well, you don't have to find a jury verdict. You have to find some way to mimic a jury verdict, as if that meant something. In this court, they've moved away from that, and the plaintiff is now contending that it's what a reasonable adjuster could determine over the course of time, which is exactly what Mr. Bell did in evaluating the case. One thing that the plaintiff has done is it's very myopic in the sense that the plaintiff sort of contends that everything should be viewed separately, that there should be an accept or reject button on the concept of the liability. State Farm did not accept the liability in this case. It simply assessed the case by assessing the liability, assessing the damages as it understood them, the same thing that any plaintiff's attorney would do. It isn't that there's an empirical, pure, or pristine value as to a particular claim or a particular type of treatment. It is that as part of the overall art of evaluating the claim, if a plaintiff's attorney, for example, took a claim, this exact same claim, and went to State Farm and said to State Farm, my client was injured sometime during the period from May through September 2008. And he has a claim here, and I think that I want to make it. And he made it to State Farm in the context of litigation or in the context of just negotiations. And he would say, well, I know that there's no reporting of this claim. I know there are no witnesses. I know that he reported it anywhere from 6 to 7 to 8 months later. As part of the concept of the settlement, I'm going to give some degrading or some valuation based upon the unlikelihood that this actually happened. That's what happens every single day during the course of litigation.
Well, that's fine. I understand that, you know, settlements involve paying less than full value.
Yes.
Did your insured understand that he was receiving less than the policy limits?
I'm not suggesting, well, less than the policy limits? Absolutely. Absolutely. He testified, and his wife testified, Marion Price, that they went over the policy together, and they both knew that there was $100,000 in uninsured motorist limits. He absolutely knew that.
And did he also know that part of his policy coverage was for lost wages?
I don't know, Your Honor, and I don't know that State Farm needs to know. The policy at 3902, I'm sorry, the statute at 18 Delaware Code 3902 actually says the same thing that the policy says about bodily injury and property damage. In fact, 3902, the UM statute, tracks 21 Delaware Code Section 2902, the liability statute. One mirrors the other. It is not the obligation of a UM carrier, or an automobile carrier, I should say, to write different policy language. It's the obligation of the individual.
I'm not talking about what the policy language is. I'm talking about a settlement that was offered at a time when the insured apparently did not realize that he had a claim for lost wages.
Your Honor, I mentioned this to a plaintiff's attorney the other day, you know, about all the things that were contended, that it was State Farm's obligation to analyze whether the plaintiff had financial issues, to determine whether he had the education, experience, or skill to negotiate, whether he understood all of the elements of the claim. And her response to me was, oh, yes. You mean State Farm was supposed to be the plaintiff's attorney? And that is the issue, Your Honor, because what Mr. Spadaro said, both in the brief and here today, just pick up the phone and call Dr. Races, find out about the loss of earnings claim. Assuming for the moment that Dr. Races would take the time out of his day to actually respond to a claim representative, and putting aside the technical niceties of whether Dr. Races could actually divulge the patient's own private medical information, contrary to the HIPAA Act.
Okay, I think you're not really addressing what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about State Farm having some obligation to develop Mr. Price's claim for him as if you were his attorney. I'm asking whether State Farm advised him that he has a claim for lost wages, if not a claim, that lost wages is a part of what's covered in his policy.
What Mr. Bell testified to is that he explained to Mr. Price twice, once in February 2009 and again in May 18, 2010, that what he was getting was the equivalent of whatever claim he had against the tortfeasor. That is, he didn't use the word tortfeasor, but he referenced the liability claim. It's equivalent to the liability claim. It is not the responsibility of the UM carrier to explain, as the advocate for the insured, that you may have a permanency claim, you may have a loss of consortium claim,
so you may have a loss of earnings claim. So he didn't explain to the insured in so many words.
He did not.
All right. One contention that we need to focus on, because it was advanced by Mr. Spadaro, is that that State Farm had an obligation, you know, whether under the the statute, the fair trade statute, or the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, to communicate to the insured, not necessarily in writing, why the insured was being offered less than the entire coverage limit.
Your Honor, the Unfair Claims Practices Act, 18 Delaware Code, Section 2304, has no private cause of action. But aside from that, to get to the question Your Honor asked, the statute refers to compromises. There was no compromise here. It was simply what Mr. Spadaro was saying is that
whether it was a compromise or not, in order for Mr. Spadaro, at least as I understood his argument, was telling us that in order for that contract to be regarded as final and binding, it had to be accompanied by or preceded by an explanation of why only $50,000 rather than the full $100,000 limit of coverage. My question is, what is State Farm's response to that argument?
The response is, Your Honor, is that there's no obligation on the behalf of any party, whether it be the plaintiff to the defendant or the defendant to the plaintiff, to explain all of the elements of why an offer is being made. When the plaintiff's attorney makes a demand, that plaintiff's attorney says, I want this, whether he explains it or whether he doesn't makes no difference. Similarly, when the defense, whether it be the insurer or the defendant, makes an offer, there's no obligation to go through all the elements of the offer. You simply make it. There was no compromise here, Your Honor, whether the policy limits were $100,000 or $1 million or higher. State Farm had an obligation on its own behalf, on behalf of its insurer to a certain extent, to evaluate the claim and make an offer. There was no compromise to be made here. I think the argument that the plaintiff is making is that any time you offer less than the policy limits, somehow that's a compromise, and that's not a compromise at all.
As I understand their argument, it almost as if, because there are policy limits, under what's new to me, a characterization as a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing arising out of an insurance contract, if you offer less than policy limits in order to meet the expectations of the claimant, which apparently is always from this date forward policy limits, regardless of the circumstances, you have to explain to the claimant why you're not offering policy limits, your legal rationale, your analysis of liability, how you've assimilated the facts carefully to determine what the out-of-pocket expenses are or what's owed under the policy, a statement about why these kinds of claims are available and the others are not. When did that happen? When has that become the law?
It's not the law, Your Honor, unless your court rules it that way. Because the reality is...
What would be the source? What would be the principal basis or the statutory source for imposing that obligation on an insurance carrier?
There is none, Your Honor. And essentially, that would make the insurance carrier an attorney, because the insurance carrier would then be obligated to know all of the legal obligation, that is, let me rephrase that, know all of the legal elements of a claim. It would be required to know all the law that would be applicable to that particular claim, and then to put it in writing to the other side. And I don't know why you'd have to distinguish between the unrepresented plaintiff and the represented plaintiff, or as the tax attorney identified in the plaintiff's brief, or the unsophisticated plaintiff involved here. What the plaintiff is doing is obligating the carrier to make a decision as to the motives of why the plaintiff accepts the money, the intelligence and skills of the plaintiff in accepting the money, and his understanding of all the legal obligations and obligations such as permanency and loss of earnings, past, present, and future. And even if there is no loss of earnings claim, because there was none in this case, we served interrogatories in the November 2011, asking if there's a loss of earnings, and the answer was to be supplied. So even the plaintiff's attorney didn't know. So how far does that go? Because if the plaintiff says, I don't have a loss of earnings, are you supposed to say, are you sure? Have you looked into it far enough? To answer Your Honor's question, there is no legal basis for what the plaintiff proposes, and it would put the insurance carrier in the position of being either counsel or an advocate for the plaintiff, and that's not an obligation that exists. There is an adversarial relationship. It need not be antagonistic. It need not be mean-spirited, but the insurance carrier stands in the shoes of the tortfeasor, and it is not required to be the advocate for the plaintiff, and that's what the plaintiff wants us to do. I have nothing further to answer any questions, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Your Honor, very briefly, there are too many straw men set up for us to knock them all down. We're not arguing that the insurance company has to intuit that the insured expects policy limits or anything like that. The duty of good faith and fair dealing is measured by what the insurance company knew or reasonably could know, because insurance companies actually have a duty to investigate. This gentleman told them repeatedly, I'm worried about my lost future earnings. They ignored that. They didn't ask about his lost future earnings. They're allowed to figure that, well, his doctor will be uncooperative, so we don't even have to investigate. We don't have to pick up the phone and call his doctor. We don't have to write a letter to his doctor because we can just assume he's not going to cooperate.
You don't seriously contend that they could pick up the phone and call the doctor without a medical authorization going in writing signed by the claimant, do you?
When you sign a PIP application, there's a medical authorization in the form PIP application. So
doctor's office is going to give that information without a release from the patient?
The PIP application contains a medical authorization signed by the applicant. They on these auto claims, they always go for it. And if they need an authorization, they can call their insured and ask for one. They have a duty to investigate. They knew that this man would have a claim for lost future earnings. They know it's not explained in their policy. And despite the requirement of Section 230416, they never explained it to him. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Right.